Welcome to the AC Podcast. This is Terry Crosby.
Andy Steiger.
Steve Kim.
Welcome back, boys. It seems like it's been a long time.
It's been a while, Terry, but it's good to be in your presence.
All right. We got an article today. Let's talk about aliens.
Absolutely. I've been waiting for you to say that for a long time.
The article we have today is, "I don't believe in aliens anymore. Humanity must learn to find meaning without relying on gods or extraterrestrials." But I just want to give a little bit of context to the article, first of all. We're going to go back to 1950. Enrico Fermi was an architect of the atomic bomb, a father of the radioactive research, and a Nobel Prize winner. He was just talking with some other scientists about UFOs, and he has come to be associated with three words: where is everybody? So this has come to be known as the Fermi paradox. I mean, we're such a young Earth, a young planetary system. Everything else has been going on for, you know, hundreds, thousands, millions of years. So why hasn't those civilizations come and reached out to us and made contact with us? So this was his question. Where is everybody?
Can I just take that a step further? Because I periodically have people ask me, Andy, do you believe in aliens? And my answer is a firm no. I do not believe that there is a universe full of other life. Maybe it's possible that there could be aliens out there. However, we could never know them, or we will never meet them, unless the laws of physics are different than they currently seem to be. We can take a telescope and we can look out throughout the universe that we can see, and we see nothing. And I think some people don't realize how big the universe is. Just take our galaxy for a moment.
Yeah.
Okay. Our galaxy, if you ever look up in the night sky and you see the Milky Way, right, which is just a bunch of stars up there, if you went from one end of the Milky Way to the other, going the speed of light, Terry, it's even faster than you drive. It's hard to believe. It would take you over 100,000 years to traverse that.
Yeah.
That is a problem, man. I mean, so we're talking about a universe that is humongous. So even if there were aliens out there, how would they ever get here in a time in which the universe is going to be dead by the time they get here?
But certainly the argument is there's lots of space. So there has to be life out there, right? Maybe they can't reach us, but there has to be life. Let me just give you a couple statistics. Like, you were getting into statistics there. So a new study finds that one in five stars, like our own sun, have an Earth-like planet orbiting around it. We have about 40 billion planets that could support life in the Milky Way galaxy. Okay, that information, I'm not even sure what to do with it. 40 million planets. Okay, a billion planets. Sorry, my bad. So today, they estimate that there is 500 billion billion sun-like stars with 100 billion billion Earth-like planets in our universe. I mean, my brain is just like, I don't understand those numbers.
Yeah, that's not a number that you can really wrap your head around. When you hear the number, it's just words, sounds that strike your eardrums. I've had friends who said something very similar to that, right? Just look at the sheer size of the universe and the number of stars and planets and so on and so forth. So if you go simply by that, if that's all that your metric is, then sure, you know, it's very highly likely that there will be other alien life forms out there. But that's not all that you need in order for you to have biological life.
Well, I think we got to be careful on what we mean by that, though, right, Steve? I mean, is it highly probable just because you have lots of opportunity that something as complex as life could be possible? I one time heard J.P. Moreland in a lecture he was giving. He just said this, and it was at the beginning of the lecture. he makes an offhanded comment where he says, well, even if there were aliens, that would be even more evidence that God exists. And then he just continued on in his lecture. No one heard anything else he said after that, right? Because I remember, like, as soon as it was Q&A time, that was the first question. It was the only thing anyone was thinking about at that point. You know, JP, what do you mean aliens would be even greater evidence for the existence of God? And his reply was, well, we know that life is so improbable, and by life, we're talking about the simplest life, a cell, a living cell. When you look at the number of amino acids that need to be sequenced into proteins and the number of proteins required to make a living cell, those numbers are so astronomical, JP saying, that listen, if it happened more than once, now what you've got is, especially if we're talking about, by the way, this is an interesting argument. If aliens did reach us, okay, that means that life evolved somewhere else in the universe way, way before it happened here, so much so that they became so advanced that they either traveled here at the speed of light, let's imagine, or just shy of, or somehow there's some sort of way to wrinkle time, if you will, right? And you can tesseract your way here, who knows? But imagining they got here, so now you're saying that that highly, highly improbable event took place not just once, but twice, and with even less amount of time somewhere else in the universe. JP then is going to say, well, listen, that's just even greater evidence that God exists.
That points to a designer, right? That's why we say that it's a greater piece of evidence for God's existence if aliens exist. One thing that I wanted to point out is that so if you look at the improbability of life being generated, biological life being generated, let alone advanced life forms like ourselves that can think, so on and so forth, there are two hoops that you have to jump through. So for one, the planet itself has to be a particular kind of planet in order for life to be even possible. It's a necessary condition. So, you know, it has to be in the Goldilocks zone within the galaxy. It can't be too close to the center of the galaxy because the gravity is too strong or something like that. Or within the solar system, you have to be within a certain kind of a place. It has to be around a certain kind of a star. It's a yellow main sequence star. And then it has to be a terrestrial planet, not a gas giant, so on and so forth, right?
And then another big one, just to add to that, is it needs to have a rather large moon.
Right. And the size of our moon is actually on the big side. It's a bit too big for the size of our planet. Now, so that's the first tier. That's a necessary condition. That doesn't mean life has to happen now. It's a necessary condition, not a sufficient condition. But then once you jump through that hoop, now you have to talk about how, you know, just like you said, Andy, how amino acids come together and all of that kind of stuff. So you have to jump through that now. And then the question is, does that necessarily lead to the evolution of intelligent species, or is it just going to produce some lower forms
moss
of life? Yeah, it's something like that, right? And so
there's some green ooze on a galaxy far, far away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's
so
oozing.
When you put all of these things together, then you can kind of see how improbable life actually is. Like, sentient species that have these like technological advancements and all of that kind of stuff, how improbable that is.
So when scientists today talk about life, they're talking about that microbe or the algae, right?
Yeah.
They're not talking about intelligent life. I think a lot of scientists these days are going away from that. And this article that we brought today is kind of indicating the mindset that they're moving towards.
Oh, I think that scientists have lowered their expectations. And at this point, they're just hoping to find water somewhere, right? Right? Let alone anything else. And so any form of life is going to be huge, no matter how simplistic it is. Now, there's a point, though, that needs to be made here. And William Dembski makes a really good point about improbability, at which point in time it's no longer improbable, it's just impossible. And one of the things that he talks about is something called something that he calls the probabilistic resources of the universe. And his point being that something at a certain level of complexity becomes impossible when there is not enough opportunity, space, nor time for that rare event to even occur. And this is something that particularly with life, and when we're talking about amino acids, proteins, and cells, is quite easy to calculate. So we can ask, what's the simplest life form? How complex is that simplest life form? What would be the odds by random chance that those sequence of amino acids would form into a correct protein, and that those correct proteins would come together into a cell? You can crunch those numbers, and what you see is the odds are so astronomical that even though the universe is huge and old, there's not enough opportunity or time for these sorts of rare events to even occur.
That's a really good point, because some critics will say, well, it's possible, right? It must have happened if we're here. That sort of response goes against our experience, intuition, and everything. Because if you're playing cards with somebody and your opponent keeps getting royal straight flush 10 times in a row, it's really unlikely that this person is going to get royal straight flush even one time. But if this person keeps getting like 5 times in a row, 10 times in a row, you're not going to just sit there thinking, oh, well, it's possible. And so it kind of reminds me of that scene from Dumb and Dumber.
What I meant was, I like you, Mary. I like you a lot. I want to ask you a question straight out, flat out. I want you to give me the honest answer. What do you think the chances are of a guy like you and a girl like me ending up together?
Well, Lloyd, that's difficult to say. We really don't...
Hit me with it. Just give it to me straight. I came a long way just to see you, Mary. Just least you can do is level with me. What are my chances?
Not good.
You mean not good like 1 out of 100?
I'd say more like 1 out of 1,000,000.
So you're telling me there's a chance? Yeah!
Right, so that's what it kind of reminds me of. When the probabilities are so, so low in any other discipline, when we look at this, we're going to say, well, it's basically impossible. I mean, logically, yes, it's possible, but the probability is so low, you would practically consider that impossibility.
Now, listen, I don't want to beat a dead dog, so I'm only going to take one more hit at it, and then I think we should move on. But this is the reason why people will postulate the multiverse, is because realizing you don't have enough time, opportunity for that rare event to take place in our universe, you just posit more universes. Now, if you want an interesting thought experiment, I thought about this one the other day, and I've even talked to some mathematicians about it because it bothered me. It's something I still ponder. But what got me thinking about this is we had 200 people playing a game of paper, rock, scissors. And what we did was, if you won your game of paper, rock, scissors, so imagine you having 100 matches because there's 200 people. If you won, you stayed standing, everyone else sat. And then you played paper, rock, scissors again. Whoever won stayed standing, everyone else sat. And you went from 200 people all the way down to one, and you had one winner. One person was playing paper, rock, scissors and didn't lose a single game. Then I began to think about that, and I was thinking, no matter how large of a number you calculate, you have to, by necessity, have a winner that will have won all of those games of paper, rock, scissors. Through that thought experiment, you can begin to appreciate why some people would say, listen, it has to be possible. The thing is you have to think about, well, how big of a game of paper, rock, scissors do we need for that to be possible. And then again, once you see that the universe isn't big enough for that game to play out, you then just start positing multiverse, in which you have so many universes, an opportunity, that this idea that it has to be necessary. But I think the important idea to keep in mind here is what you're dealing with at this point then is faith. So you have faith that this is what occurred. Is there evidence for that multiverse? No, but some people would argue, well, we're here, so it must have happened. Now, let's just move all that aside. So aliens are interesting to talk about. There's the reason why I don't believe that they exist. I'm sure Steve is still thinking about my paper, rock, scissors illustration.
I've never heard that illustration before, so I'm definitely going to steal that one.
It's not bad, hey?
Yeah, it's actually really good. It's easy to understand.
I want to look at this article, because this article that Terry found was a really interesting one. We're going to post it on show notes. If you got time, I'd encourage you to read it. As I went through this article, I could tell immediately that this individual knew their literature well, almost too well. So when I got to the bottom of the article, I quickly looked to see who this was and saw that they were an English prof. And then I thought, oh, okay, this makes sense. But the other thing I wanted to look at is it was clear that this was not a philosopher. Because this individual was very confused. And so I want to take a moment to just untangle some of the philosophical mess within this article, because I see this taking place in our culture regularly. And one of the things that came out in the article that I'm very convinced of, I'm in agreement with and seeing played out, is that many people are starting to say that we are living in a post-secular society. And I see that. I tell people, for example, when I went to Aberdeen for the first time in Scotland, where I'm doing my PhD, my first day on campus, they were having a crystal bazaar. So it was like a new age bazaar for going and buying and selling your crystals. And I've been amazed at how popular new age thinking is, how pervasive it is. And in particular, when you would think, oh, Europe, I'm sure that's so secular there. And I've said this before on our show. No, it's actually not that secular at all. It's very new age in its beliefs. A lot of belief in spirits, ghosts, those sorts of things. Not what you would think for a secular culture at all. And so I would say, though, that a part of that cultural milieu of new age thinking and spirits is a lot of this alien type thinking. However, given, you know, the lack of evidence for aliens, we're starting to see people kind of move away from that and move more into the new age type thinking.
I mean, in the article, he did argue that this post-secular culture has always been around. Because he said that because of the belief in aliens and God, it's very similar.
Yeah, as people have stopped believing in God, they started believing more in aliens. And yeah, Now that they're not believing as much in aliens, they've moved on to artificial intelligence. And he's basically saying they're going to move on from artificial intelligence as well.
Right.
One of the things that he brings up that I think is interesting, I just want to talk about this briefly. You know, have you ever thought about, you know, Steve, Terry, have you guys ever just thought about this view that God, and now let's just use the Christian God, you know, Yahweh, viewing that God as you would view an alien, that this God, you know, or okay, this alien is just really powerful and created everything and created us. Does using that lens, A, is it appropriate? And B, how does it change your view of the way that you see God?
Well, for me, the problem is that kind of a God is really no different than gods of ancient Greco-Roman mythology or any kind of polytheistic god, because they're all within space and time. I mean, it's just a difference of degree, but not in kind. But when I talk about God, this is very different from that. This kind of God is one that transcends the universe.
Space, time.
Yeah. So the difference between these polytheistic gods and monotheistic God is the difference between characters in The Lord of the Rings and J.R.R. Tolkien. Mm-hmm. So there are characters within the story, Tolkien is wholly other than these characters. He is outside of the story. He is the creator of the story. This is one complaint that I have against my atheist and other skeptic friends, is that when they talk about Yahweh, they talk about Yahweh as though he is a polytheistic god, one of many, right? You know, because they'll say something like, well, you don't believe in Zeus or Thor, I just go one god further, right? That's a category error.
And so, they're just going to put, you know, along with Zeus, aliens. I completely agree with you, Steve, that that's exactly what they're doing. Mm-hmm. I also think it's important to understand that under theism, we are talking about monotheism. So we're talking about one God that created everything, in whose nature is existence itself. And this God who then would be the creator of everything that exists. This is a lot different than the kind of ideas you'll often see, say, if you're watching like Guardians of the Galaxy or something like that. And, you know, you've got an alien that's being viewed as a god. Mm-hmm. That's not really what they're doing. What they're doing is just talking about a really powerful alien that's different than talking about God. That's one of the reasons why I think that perfect being theology can be very helpful at this point.
This is where some of those philosophical and apologetic arguments come into play. Like you were indirectly referring to the ontological argument. So you start with the concept of God, the definition of God as the being then which none greater can be conceived, you know, and then it goes to show that, if it's even possible that God exists, then he must exist because existence is one of those great making properties. Or you can talk about the first cause argument, like the Kalam cosmological argument, which argues that, well, our universe began to exist, and so there must be something that started it all. You know, something can't come from nothing. And so, well, let's look at what kind of a being this is. Well, whatever this being is, insofar mm-hmm. as we understand that the universe, what we mean by the universe is time, space, and everything inside it, then whatever this cause is has to be outside of time and space. It has to be able to exist timelessly and spacelessly. And then it has all kinds of other entailments there. These arguments then point to a being that is very close to the monotheistic concept of God.
Now, what's interesting about that, Steve, is you can then apply that to even yourself, to ask some important questions about ourselves and who we are. And in fact, in the article, that's exactly what this author begins to do, as he, in the article, decides he wants to think up of an alien and begins to realize, oh, that's passé. Maybe I could do something else, and begins to think of himself as an alien. And really, he clearly hasn't read Immanuel Kant, because he really goes into this Kantian contemplation of him as a knower, him as a mind. And we could ask a really simplistic but significant, profound question, and that is simply this. Which is more real, your mind or your brain?
I would tend to lean towards the mind. I guess the reason I lean in that direction is that now there is something that I can know with 100% certainty, that I have a mind. Even the fact that I'm talking right now, even the fact that I can question my own existence, tells me that I have a mind. So I guess from that certainty, it seems to me that the mind is more real. Now, of course, my certainty doesn't necessarily equate whether something is more real or not, but I guess it has that effect of it at least gives me that illusion of, yeah, this seems more real to me than physical things, right?
And this becomes a real challenge. And in the article, this guy begins to think about this, as he's like, well, I'm kind of an alien myself in that I'm a thinking alien. And I have these thoughts and I have these tastes and other sensations. But the question really becomes, although I think I'm touching Terry currently, like his hand here. Terry's moving away his hand.
Back off.
But am I actually touching anything? Or am I only feeling or having the sensation of touching something or tasting something or seeing something? And as you begin to ponder it, you begin to realize that you've never had any direct contact with the physical world. All that you in fact have had is this Kantian idea of a pre-digested sensation that the brain is interpreting and that you're experiencing as a mind. Now, you're making the assumption, though, that there in fact is a brain that in fact is touching something physical. How would you prove that there actually is a physical world? This is a question that Descartes posed. How do I know that I'm not, if I follow out what this guy was thinking in his article about, okay, this alien, how do I know that I'm not just a thinking thing? Because it seems to me, and I would agree with you, Steve, it's the only thing that I can actually be confident in. I have more confidence that I'm a mind than I do that I'm a brain. But you can go so far with that that you end up in what's called idealism. And now you have to ask, well, how do I know that I'm not just a mind then?
One of the things that I use as a guide, if you will, is my moral intuition. And so when I think about, for example, you know, heaven forbid someone were to break into my house and I have a little daughter who's about to turn 5, and let's say this guy breaks into the house and does something horrible to her. If idealism holds true, that there is just the mind and nothing else, I'm thinking to myself, how do I make sense of what this guy did to my daughter? Is it just a mind-to-mind contact? Through my moral intuition, I can clearly perceive that this is an evil act. Mm-hmm. The reason this is a horrific act is that the sanctity of her body has been violated. And so if I'm just a mind...
Well, I've heard idealists argue, and they would argue, no, it's still a horrific act because it's a violation of the mind instead of a violation of the body. I would actually argue a little bit differently against idealism. In fact, I would use Descartes' argument as he thought about, okay, is there just some sort of evil demon out there that, you know, is tricking me and I'm just this mind, but I think I have a body. Ultimately, Descartes went to theism and ultimately his Christianity, right? And he would say, no, there's a God who exists and I have good reason to believe that created me. And now the question is whether or not that's a good God or not. If that's a good God, well, then that God's not trying to trick me. And then I can have confidence that God has made me in such a way that I'm perceiving the world correctly, both through my mind and my brain. In particular, though, for him, he was concerned about the physical aspect. Can I be confident of those things? Mm-hmm. And ultimately, under that kind of theism, and I think Descartes' right in this, it's only there that I can have actual confidence that the physical world exists. Now, I just got to say here, this to me is the irony of secularism. Secularism is predicated on the idea that the brain is more real than the mind. And in fact, there's these different philosophies such as emergentism or supervenience. They would say, oh, the mind is just supervenient or emergent. It's a property of the brain. But ultimately, it's reducible to brain. To me, this is the irony, is that you have more confidence in the brain, but it's through the mind that you're perceiving everything. You're cutting off the branch you're sitting on. That's a whole nother argument, a different argument that we could get into, but I won't. Mm-hmm. But just to say, we could flip Descartes' argument, though, to show, I think, Steve, that we have good reason to believe that idealism isn't, or just mind isn't the case. And that is that God seems to have created us in such a way to believe that we both have a mind and a brain. And so I think we could apply the same argument and ask, well, is God trying to trick me into believing that I actually have a body, but in fact, I'm only a mind? And I think that we have good reason to believe that we in fact are both a mind and a brain, and that this is the way that God has created us. It's interesting in this article, kind of switching gears here, that one of the things that he brings up is he's pondering the mind and how complex all of this is, you know, a human being. He makes mention that our species, he says, hosts what is probably the only example of technological intelligence, and that the human brain will most likely remain the most complex organization of matter in the universe. Something that's interesting about that, I've often had these moments where I'm looking at old photos. You're looking at these people in these old photos, and they've got, you know, these old technologies. And just the thought occurs to me as I'm looking at these old photos that you're looking at this technology that is so archaic, but yet here is this person holding it, and that this person is the most complex, you know, the most sophisticated technology that we can even understand still to date. It's this moment for me when I'm looking at, you know, these old photos, is just a reminder that, and I know this might seem like an odd thing, just a reminder that in fact we are amazingly created, and that in some ways, yes, we are alien. And the Apostle Paul even kind of brings up this language in the Bible, that we in fact are alien, but in another way that we're not. In that we have been created by God, we've been created in a sophisticated way in which we bear His image and are made in a way that we can have meaningful relationship. And it's interesting the weird places that people tend to move on to or try to think through when they try to divorce themselves from God and try to posit all sorts of other things in there to try to make sense of the universe, from aliens to different types of gods and whatever else. When in reality, this is one of those things about being a Christian that grounds me and excites me, and I find so encouraging, is that I find in Christianity answers that make sense of who and what I am, that inspire me, and that I find nowhere else.
Well, there's a lot to this article today, and we talked a little bit about it, and there's a lot more you could read about with the article, so we'll post that on the show notes. But thank you for joining us, listeners. The AC Podcast is a ministry of Apologetics Canada, and we'll be back next week with more things to think about.